I'm Christopher Lydon with the performance poet Reggie Gibson, listening for the sound and sense of poetry in our midst, in our time, listening for the tradition, for the fresh directions of poetry today on Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, about almost anything. In the run-up to the wide-open Pro-Am Massachusetts Poetry Festival in October 09, the connecting question to many poets is, where does your work come from, and where is it going? Reggie Gibson, in this conversation, comes from Chicago, and the spoken word tradition you could say is as old as Homer. Reggie Gibson was crowned champion of slam poetry in 1998, but this is a poet and a teacher today, not of a moment or a movement, but of universal rhythms and experience. We met in the Grolier Bookshop in Harvard Square. Reggie Gibson, was there a poem in your childhood or your youth that got you started, that told you this is my calling?
Yeah, it's going to sound hokey. I think the very first poem that I have in conscious memory was The Raven. And it's because my mom brought home a box of books that she'd got in a secondhand store. And inside of that box of books, there was the complete works of Shakespeare. There was some works by Ben Bova. There was some works by Isaac Asimov. And there was The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. And I remember distinctly because I read it when I opened it. And it was, you know, the first lines, right? Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door, blah, 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 only this and nothing more. And it stung me because when I flipped the page, the next page was missing. It was torn in half. And I remember in my mind going, what do you mean there's nothing more? There's got to be something more. So I told my mom I wanted to go to the library and find this book so I could find that missing page. And she got around to it, took me to the library, and I found it. And that was the first thing that really hooked me. And I think it was a rhythm. It was the storytelling also mixed with this incantatory cadence and internal rhyme. Of course, I didn't know anything about these kinds of words at the time, but I just knew it drew me in a very visceral way. Of course, I was used to storytelling. My great-granddad was illiterate. And so he told stories and talked to himself as ways of remembering things. So I recognize the orature, I guess, of that poem in some of the things my great-granddad had done.
Hmm. Yeah. Place yourself, Reggie Gibson, in the tradition. How many degrees of separation between Edgar Allan Poe and you, or Walt Whitman, or Shakespeare, for that matter?
Oh, well, I don't know how I would even answer that question. I myself like to think of still having a discussion going on with all three, and then others. I prefer to think of poetry the way, I guess, most of our Eastern humans walking on this planet think of it, which is a dialogue that's sustained over periods of time. I think that's part of the issue I take with much of American poetry, is that we do tend to divide things up in eras. And therefore, you know, this is the Romantic era, this is the post-war era, this is whatever era. And we don't look at them. We tend to say, okay, well, that belongs to another age, and therefore it has nothing to offer us now. And I think if we look at it as a sustained dialogue going on between the ages, then we find that we can draw wisdom from that. And I don't think that's taught as often as it should be.
Who's in the conversation with you?
Wow. Well, I work with a group of musicians. And because of that, I like to have the kinds of poems, I think, that translate into something that people care about, but also in ways that they can understand it. I've recently started doing a lot of the works of Dickinson. I really appreciate much of what she had to offer.
For example?
Well, for instance, you know, dare you see a soul at the white heat and stand, you know, within the door. The mysticism of that, the thing that draws one back to the anvil, you know, when she's talking about the blacksmith and the anvil and the soul and the heat that's created as a result of striking the anvil, and what it takes to bend one into something of use, you know, that the song itself can inhabit, that brings me back to that mysticism in poetry. And because I plain don't understand a lot of what it is she's speaking about on an intellectual level, my intellect can't penetrate it, so I have to sort of explore it with another part of myself, which is more than intuition and that instinct, and always that bit of mystery, that thing, that sort of mercurial thing that you can't quite touch. It always evades the touch. Those are the things for me that bring me back to that. Another modern poet who I think offers that for me to some degree is Yusuf Komunyakaa. Mm-hmm. And for me, he seems to bridge what we might call high diction and low diction. He seems to bridge the worlds that I sort of walk between, the blues world and the jazz world, along with the world of academic ideas and art and philosophy. And sometimes that mix, the potent way in which he does it, always draws me back. This poem, if I can remember part of it, it's called "A Woman I Got the Blues," right? And he starts off with, "I'm wearing a floppy existential sky blue hat when we meet at the Museum of Modern Art." Later on, we hold each other with a tenderness that would break open ripe fruit, you know. And he speaks about blood funking and slow dragging to music. And then he goes into this whole thing about there's no reason why the scorpion has to be, you know, our teacher or something along those lines. But he mixes mythology, he mixes Judeo-Christian mythology along with African-American blues, along with European existentialism in this one poem. And it's this thing that I hold that's, at the same time, it's quite erotic, you know, in how he does it. So, yeah, people who bring those kinds of things together, I like to think of myself moving toward the tradition of where they are, the thing that is also of the intellect but also of the instinct.
Ralph Ellison drew an interesting line. He said, in effect, he got along better with the ancestors than with the relatives, better with Faulkner and Dostoevsky than, say, with Richard Wright or Toni Morrison.
Okay.
Does that line make any sense for you?
It makes sense if you understand Ellison. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, yes, of course, there is something the ancestors have to offer. Maybe he was being a purist in that sense.
Or a snob.
I was trying to be correct politically about that, you know. But there's also certain well-known musicians who prefer the old standard of jazz and think that's the purest part of it and have absolutely no regard for modern expressions of music. But we've always had this sort of thing going on within all the arts, even in the English language, right? You have your descriptivists and your proscriptivists, the people who believe it's supposed to be a specific kind of way, and other people say, no, language is about what's happening with the living. There are those who I think wish to enshrine art, to put it up in a museum or a mausoleum sometimes, and not understand that it has that its fullest expression is when it comes out and boogies with the people. You know, and if you can sustain that boogie and find ways to reinvigorate that, I think that's, for me, that's a worthy endeavor.
Reggie Gibson, give us a signature poem or two or three of your own, please.
Wow. I don't know if I'm old enough to have a signature poem, but I don't think I've written enough to have that. And there's also different eras, I guess, I've gone through. But one of the things that I go back to, I guess, is my upbringing. I grew up, my father was a Chicago police officer and my mother was a devout Christian fundamentalist. So that meant I couldn't have any fun, you know. So my brother and I used to have to sneak out the house and go find some fun. And I guess this is a late recollection about what that meant. Chicago in the 1980s. We go to this club. It's a teenage thing. Bass slides in on all fours, rabbit with a feral look in its eyes. Bodies twist themselves into blasphemous angles of rebellion and defiance. Something smelling like jail time cuts across the air like handfuls of cubic zirconia scratching up a plexiglass guy. Over in the corner, a cue ball, psychotic smack, cracks up a tribe of stripes and solids on a squared field of green. The black eight sinks through the smoky haze of all dams and mans, and ten spots reluctantly ruffle their ways out of pissed-off pockets. Now the DJ, who we call the priest, sits there in the pulpit in all translucent splendor, jacking the sounds, spinning the rhythms into 33 1/3 sermons, preaching the sounds of our new gospel. And the church's hands fly heavenward, exposing our palms to the angels as we hope to catch a holy hand slap from a God who's pissed off because she's got to work the night shift. Tonight, we are young, virile, sweaty with passions you've got to experience in order to understand. Tonight is our night. We don't give a damn about tympanic cartilaginous erosion of our inner ears weakened by way too many weekends of butt bumping, woofing, and tweeting. We don't give a damn about that ass whipping we're going to catch when we get back home and our parents find out we snuck out to come to this party. A little. But what we care about right now is that ass-whipping only bass and drum can give. That ass-whipping only bass and drum can heal. Cause tonight we live for strobe lights that kiss our vision and bring new sight. We live for floors that moan beneath the weight of young flippant attitudes. We live for glasses that mumble the speech of stolen kisses. And for skies that explode with the funk of flirting smiles. We live to kill our burdens, shoot them in the back of their heads and watch them give up their ghosts between the etched grooves of waxed plates. We live for the bodega crew. Coming up from Humboldt and Pilsen from the barrio, bringing those supple brown morenas with hips like congas, going bopping 6/8 rhythms from front door to dance floor. Something about them, their mouths opening wide, delivering this pink tongue that swells like scarlet smoke beneath the roof of ourselves. We live for sisters, blue blacks and honey browns, heavenly ebonies getting down on legs shaped like mama's soul food. With a whole lot of attitude, calves carved magically out of hams and hocks, with backsides big and round and begging to get buttered like grandmama's biscuits. Good Lord, their hair picked out, slicked out, icked out, tricked out into an asymmetrical isosceles rhomboid parallelogram and a few other shapes that defy geometric explanation. Tonight, we are young. Virile, sweaty with passions you've got to experience in order to understand. Tonight is our night to hold somebody's body close to us, firm to us, feel the thin, wispy slivers of their breath invade our ears like well-trained mercenaries, bring them slow and close on a slow jam, heaving against the mask of teenage knowing and adolescent pretense. Something deeply inside of us that used to write on caves at Lascaux understands that this moment belongs to us. This moment will never come again. This moment contains a forever, and eternal memories are strung together, one forever at a time. Tonight we are young, virile, sweaty with passions you've got to experience in order to understand, and we don't care or give a damn that our parents don't want to understand that sweat is a friend of ours. And tonight, we've got to get real, real friendly. It's funny, my mom read that poem some years later, and she was like, "You guys did that more than once?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah." She's like, "Oh, okay, you know." So now that my father's deceased and my mother's, you know, a little bit elderly, I can outrun him, you know, so I don't have to worry about her coming to get me. But my mother is a Southern woman, and she now lives in El Paso, Texas, and anyone who knows anything about Southern black women, you know they will find you. If they have to. So, but yeah.
Thank you, Mom. Thank you, Reggie.
Certainly. The poems that come out of repression.
For the record, you delivered that without looking at a note, mm-hmm. and you perform it.
Yes.
Is that your mode?
Some of it, yes. Some of the ones that are orature, that only live, is fullest, rather, when the voice is put to it. Those are the ones I do my best either to memorize or to try to read them in such a way that they're reminiscent of the old way of giving poems.
You know? The ideal way, you think?
To some degree. We have ears for a reason. We're creatures of sound. You know, when we're floating there in the amniotic darkness, you know, the thing we respond to is the sound. So reading lends itself more to an intellectual way, and the hearing lends itself to something that's more visceral. That moves us in a different kind of way. I think it was Stanley Kunitz who said, "For the poem to find its fullest expression, it must have a voice." You know, it must have an audience that hears it. And I think that is at the beginning of the very first Dodge Poetry Festival that when Bill Moyer shot that, he said that for the poem to find its fullest expression, it must have an audience. It must have a voice.
Would you read us another?
Certainly. One of my own?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. How to become an ex-Jehovah's Witness without losing your mind. Overcome your Pavlovian desire to knock on doors. Sever the Methodist drone from your tongue. Curse its funkless infection. Imbibe an Africanized gospel. Learn to fear any church that fears drums. Hallow the mouth to devil sputter. Beat God like he stole someone from you. Pummel him until all that remains is unthunderous pulp and question. Learn to lean that question's heft on your mother's prayer until you hear it snap like dry clavicle. War into her face. Dare her to pray for you again. Forgive her, though she does. Forgive her, though she lies. Forgive her. Your name will be Iscariot. Apostate, worldly backslider, kingdom unworthy. Your mark will be that of Cain and beast. Only take lovers who can burn the Christ you were given, then only take lovers who love only ash. Learn to purgatory. Learn to pray like a fist. Learn to move through the church of this world like a pissed off priest in combat boots. Close one eye. Bless the backs turned to you. Look at your hands. Wait for the burning. Wait for the holes to appear. Holes just large enough for your fingers to doubt through. So for me, that was also about coming to terms with my particular upbringing and understanding religion is a philosophy without questions, and learning to question after you've been told not to.
Reggie Gibson, sketch the community of poets out there, maybe in your head, maybe in real life, and place yourself among them today.
Well, I'm somewhere between page and stage, always. I lean toward the tradition of relevance, I hope, not just pretty art for pretty art's sake, which for me might be good enough, but it might not be good enough for other folks or enough for other people who I need to go out and speak to. Somewhere between musician and writer, I really love performing. I love reading in front of people. I love being a part of that thing that's created when a bunch of people get together for a particular purpose.
As an American poet, Reggie Gibson, writing in English in 2009, what's your sense of the state of the art and the profession?
I think it's on an upswing now. I hope it stays that way. I think for a long time, poetry sort of languished in the shadows, being you know, the literary bastard child, I suppose. I will reiterate, as long as it stays relevant or can get back to such things as relevance, I think that people will pull toward it. After 9/11, for instance, poetry was one of the things that was sought. It was sought because of the succor and comfort that it gives people. And it brought people sought it out in ways that they did not seek out full-length books, for instance, you know. Walt Whitman was someone I sought out, you know. I felt the need to sound my barbaric yawp across the rooftops of the world when that happened. And someone, when I felt my country welling up with an anger, you know, and sometimes that anger can bring us back to a sort of irrational behavior. I went to Whitman to get a better understanding or to remind myself of what it meant to be in a democracy, you know, how it takes all things to make this work. And I find that thing always remains true to us when we seek it out. The unfortunate thing is that it takes tragedy before many of us go and want to seek it out and not understand that it can sustain us in between tragedies, as I like to think.
You're working with high school students in connection with the Massachusetts Poetry Festival. They're learning from you. What are you learning from them?
Well, I haven't worked with them yet, but if I learn from them what I've learned from every other high school student that I've worked with is, number one, to always stay honest, because they can really sniff when you're not. You know, this is a generation that prides itself on cynicism, and they've been pummeled by words that are designed to make them nothing but tools of service unto somebody else's way of thinking. and liberate the few coins they have from their pockets, so they recognize a hustle, you know. So to always try to stay honest, to always speak truthfully with them. The other thing is that how honest they can really sometimes be with themselves. They put it out there. And yes, you know, those of us who are more experienced in poetry, we might call it sentimentality and blah, 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 and whatever it is they're doing. But they don't know enough as of this moment to lie about how they feel. You know, they haven't learned to put as many masks in place of that. And to learn to do that artfully, you know, is one of the things that some of the more advanced of the high school poets always teach me, the how to get back to that thing that brought you to this whole craft. You know, they remind me of the love I had for the whole craft. You know, now that it's what I do for a living, or I teach or do all these other things for a living, but to get back to that usia, right? That primal ground from which you sprang is what they bring me back to. And I appreciate all of them for having done so.
What's the message from them about the future of poetry?
Well, they're coming through it to poetry through song. You know, most of they hear a lot more than they read, you know, and now they can walk around with buds in their ears like I did when I was a kid and have their whole soundtrack played out for them. I think that if it's a poetry that pays no attention to how the youth listen and hear and relate, then I'm not sure. I weep for the future that poetry could have. But at the same time, we can't always give the youth what they want in place of what they need. So we have to find a way to bridge that gap. How do we make, let's say, Shakespeare relevant to them in their words? How do we make the Iliad relevant for them? And I've found that if we do that, they reach toward it. I did a lecture called The Iliad as Gangster Rap, in which I take on the persona of Achilles as a gangster rapper, speaking about his anger with Agamemnon. Mm. And I've had several high school students tell me they've gone back to read the Iliad. They recognized, you mean Troy wasn't it? You know, no, Troy was not quite it. But so they've gone back to read it because the way it was given to them was a way that they related to. It was in a way that they hear nowadays. And hopefully by going to read the Iliad, maybe they'll pick up, you know, the Homeric hymns, right? Maybe they'll read the Theogony. Maybe they'll read Works and Days. Maybe they'll read Sappho. You know, maybe they'll read Lucretius. Maybe they'll read Catullus or, you know, Catullus. Maybe they'll read these people. I know this much. If they got through the Iliad, they can certainly handle the rest of those, you know. And one or two that I've had the discussions with, they've seen the times mirrored in the Iliad. So, yes, if we bring it to them in a way that's not beating them over the head with something they think is irrelevant, right, then poetry does have a future.
Reggie Gibson, I'd like to ask you our version of the Proust questionnaire. Mm-hmm. Who's your favorite artist in another medium?
I would say, if I was to say music, Jimi Hendrix. Hmm. I constantly go back to Jimi Hendrix. He mixed so many things together, number one, and he was forward-thinking. His lyrics befuddle me, you know, most of the time. But I place him also in the context of an Obeah man, right, or a conjure man, or a shaman. In art, the two people who have me right now, it's going to sound real strange, but the two people who have me right now is Caravaggio and Rothko. You know, I can't really tell you why. Different eras, totally different painting. And one is muted and the other is just in your face. But it's something about Caravaggio that has the shadows that play that always bring me back to that. A person who constantly still in art scares the living daylights out of me ever since I was a 7-year-old kid is Salvador Dali. I remember looking at what I came to know was the Temptation of St. Anthony when I was a kid. And transfixed by it. It scared me so badly, you know, at that time. The phantasmagoria and the mixture of the sacred and the profane kept bringing me back to it for years to come. I still don't think I've quite transcended my fear of it. If I was to say in fiction, an African writer I try to read once a year, Ayekwe Arma. He has a book called 2,000 Seasons, which I find to be one of the most lush pieces of poetic historical writing that I've ever read, and I constantly go back to him as well.
What would you say is the keynote of your personality as a poet?
I guess since I didn't listen to Eliot very closely, I did not extinguish my personality. I don't know. I like to have fun on the stage. I like to bring together, I don't know, Shakespeare and the blues. So for me, I always have a playful sense of what can be done with words.
What's the talent you'd most love to have or to develop?
Wow. The talent, a facility with higher mathematics would really be good right now for me. You know, I'm falling in love with so many things that I shunned when I was younger. I would love that. I would love to be able to play a musical instrument. I play the drums, you know, but I'd love to be able to play the violin. I'd love to be able to do that.
Which historical poet do you most identify with?
Well, somewhere between Pablo Neruda and another gentleman named Guylain Cane. Hmm. Neruda really opened my head to metaphor. And he was such a romantic. I like to think of myself as a romantic, though my ex-wife might say different.
What's the quality you like most in a poem?
Well, that depends on the day you catch me, but I do admire music in a poem, but that's not enough. But if there's one that I admire the most, that's difficult, because you can have music but have no narrative, have no story to it. You can also have a story that plods along and pays no attention to the ear. Imagination. Imagination in a poem, I think is very important. New approaches, new takes on old material is very important. Probably the most important thing for me.
Richie Gibson, do you have a motto?
My motto, we are all individual flames that tend to burn brightest when we come together.
Reggie Gibson, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Christopher. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with the poet Reggie Gibson. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern helped get us ready and listen. Thanks also to the Grolier Bookshop for letting us into their hallowed studio, so to speak. You can link to more of Reggie Gibson's life and writing, and you can pitch a comment, please, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.